Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. Today, we're going to have a terrific show for you. We have as our guest a Nobel Prize-winning economist, one of the great economists of our times, author of a provocative new critique of the state of U.S. capitalism and policymaking, Joseph E. Stiglitz, joining us for the full hour today on Media Matters. Should be a wonderful show. First, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting has announced a major journalism initiative that will increase original local reporting in seven regions around the country. Patricia Harrison, president and CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, says that the public media system is uniquely structured to increase regional reporting.
Our mission is to take that 30,000-foot view of how public media, television and radio, now online, how are they meeting the needs in this any changing environment. And it's obvious that journalism is going through a big change, and we saw a need to fill. A need that was specifically fillable given our mission and our commitment over the last 40 years to both education and journalism.
The centers will be comprised of 3 to 7 public media stations in specific geographic areas. They'll hire teams of multimedia journalists and editors who will work with station news directors. The teams will decide on a single issue of concern for their region. Their reports will be distributed across radio, TV, and the web. The individual stations will also conduct community engagement programs. The CPB will initially fund 5 local journalism centers in the Southwest, the Plain States, upstate New York, the upper Midwest, and central Florida. 2 more will be added later this year, 1 in the South and 1 in the Northwest. Harrison says that the centers, which will initially focus on issues like upstate New York's economy, healthcare issues in central Florida, and immigration in the Southwest, will bring diversity and depth to regional reporting that has been missing in news reporting. She describes the immigration project.
They're going to hire a bilingual reporting team to look at what they're calling the Changing America Desk and look at some of the issues such as immigration and border issues that are impacting that region. But without having that bilingual sort of extra added value, you could miss some really great interviews. We're really going to have a 360-degree approach to this issue. While they have done stories on this issue, all of these stations, this really pumps it up.
The total CPB and station investment over 2 years is approximately $10.5 million, with an expectation that each center will become self-sustaining by the end of the 2-year funding period. And now, a commentary from Megan Tatey.
At last month's House hearing on Comcast's proposed takeover of NBC, executives from both companies shamefully acknowledged their diversity problems. Comcast CEO Brian Roberts divulged that his company's board of directors includes only one woman and one person of color, and NBC's Jeff Zucker confessed that the network has no black programming. Seeing Roberts and Zucker sweat under heavy fire from Congress got us wondering, what else should we be asking about these companies' woeful commitment to diversity? Media mergers have proven bad for local and diverse programming and has resulted in fewer women and fewer people of color owning media outlets. When NBC bought Spanish-language network Telemundo in 2001, it pledged more local news. But a few years after the merger was approved, NBC created cheap regional newscasts that phoned in canned coverage with an insert or two of actual local news. 9 years later, we should ask, will this happen again? How do we ensure that news coverage serving communities of color won't be further cut? How can we ensure that it improves? Another question, why are Comcast's commitments regarding Telemundo so pathetic? As part of its voluntary merger concessions, the company has promised to add Telemundo programming to Comcast's on-demand library. But that merely involves moving Telemundo reruns to a cable platform. That's a good way to generate new and expensive cable subscriptions, but it does nothing to enhance broadcast localism or program diversity for the underserved Spanish language market. One thing we cannot do is accept these companies' promises that they'll do better. That's just lip service to win merger approval. Getting NBC to feature more people of color as guests on its news program is a step in the right direction, but it's not as effective as getting the company to commit to providing more hours of local Spanish language news, or requiring Comcast to carry an independent cable channel that's owned by a person of color. If we want a system that gives us local news, diverse programming for diverse audiences, and minority media ownership, we have to change media ownership in this country, and it can begin with refusing to let Comcast and NBC merge.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We're coming to you today with our guest, Joseph Stiglitz, the winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, former chief economist for the World Bank, author of many books, most notably or most recently, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. We'll be discussing it for the next hour. Joseph Stiglitz, welcome to Media Matters.
Nice to be here.
You know, I greatly enjoyed your book. Among other things, it's probably one of the best written books on economics for a lay person that I've read, that gets through a lot of really great material, but does so in a way that doesn't require statistical expertise.
Thank you.
And, you know, I think that we're going to talk big picture issues because the book deals with the current crisis and some of the possible policy solutions. But I think some of the terms that I suspect our listeners hear a lot but aren't that familiar really with the background to, that I'd like to let you take some time to explain if you don't mind. First, Lord Keynes and Keynesian economics, something we hear a lot about, John Maynard Keynes. You identify yourself as a Keynesian in the book, refer to the tradition repeatedly. The name's come up a lot in the last year after being sort of not spoken much for decades. Can you tell our listeners a little bit, if you would, you know, who Lord Keynes was, what he did, and what Keynesian economics entails?
Yeah, he taught at Cambridge, and his most famous work was written in response to the Great Depression. The idea that had was prevalent before that was that markets were self-adjusting, unemployment could not occur, and government should not intervene. Well, as unemployment started to increase, at one point it got up to one out of four people were out of jobs, the idea that markets were self-adjusting, efficient, became less and less credible. And what he did is to try to explain what the problem was. But more than that, he came up with a number of very important ideas about how to respond. The most important one was that the government could make a difference. The major idea before that was that, often associated with Herbert Hoover, that when you go into a recession or depression, government revenues go down faster than expenditures. In fact, expenditures might go up and help pay for unemployment insurance and so forth. And the result is the deficits increase. And extreme conservatives said in that context is that what you should do is increase taxes or cut back expenditures. And what that almost always led to is making the problems worse. And he said you ought to do just the opposite. The government needs to spend. The idea was a very simple one, that what caused the problem was a lack of aggregate demand, a lack of spending. And what often happens, some catastrophe, some event, leads to a reduction in private spending, and the notion is that government needs to come in and at least temporarily fill the gap. And that's exactly what's happened in this crisis. The American households were spending beyond their means. They thought they could get away with it because they were getting richer and richer because of the housing bubble. And when the bubble broke, they realized they couldn't. They cut back on spending, and That and similar things going on in many countries around the world led to the global slowdown. And so Keynesian economics is a very simple idea. In that context, it's important for a government to step in and step on the accelerator and stimulate the economy. And this is now accepted by almost everybody on almost all economists, but not there are a few economists that hark back to the days of Hoover, Herbert Hoover, and that notion that markets always work and there's no such thing as unemployment. So it's mind-boggling, but there are some people who believe right now that the unemployed are just enjoying leisure.
No, that's from the book. I cracked up when I read that in the book. You made that comment. It also seems, though, that memo about Keynes hasn't reached the depths of the Republican Party in Washington, at least at the rhetorical level. Paul Ryan, for example, came out with an alternative Republican budget for the future. And it seemed like there was an obsession with balancing budgets that sort of was premised on the notion that the Keynesian idea of using deficits to stimulate an economy's significant stagnation or unemployment or unused resources really didn't apply.
Yeah, this is there was a moment maybe a year ago in which the joke was we were all Keynesians,
mm-hmm.
And all over the world there was support for this idea. After all, Bush used that idea repeatedly in 2001, 2003, and 2008, said that we needed to have tax cuts to stimulate the economy. It's a particular variant of the Keynesian idea. Well, after Obama got elected, they no longer talked about stimulating the economy, and they said that Keynes was wrong. I just have to say that having looked at countries all over the world who've tested this idea, and we've had a lot of experiments, and almost always governments that have responded to economic downturns by raising taxes or cutting expenditures or raising interest rates, the downturns have turned into recessions into depressions. Things have gotten worse, not better. And ironically, the deficit often actually gets increased because, of course, as the economy slows down, tax revenues get reduced. And so what originally was sold as something to improve the deficit doesn't even succeed in its original mission.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Our guest today, who you've just been listening to, is Joseph Stiglitz, the winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, professor at Columbia University, former chief economist at the World Bank, and author of the new book, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy, just out by Norton, and one of the finest books explaining the current economic crisis that I've been exposed to. We have lots of guests on the program who write books in economics, and this is at the top of the list. It's a pleasure to have you here, Joe. Don't call in today, dear listeners. We recorded this show before going on air. Sit back and let me have a monopoly on the conversation, if you will. Professor Stiglitz, in the book, you know, it's sort of I want to get into your critique of the crisis and the policies that have been adopted in a second, but a subplot in the book, if you will, is that a critique of mainstream economics and the role economists have played in sort of helping make the crisis get as bad as it got. And in particular, what's striking is sort of the Keynesian school that you come from that I was trained in the early 70s in economics, which was definitely dominant at that point, had really lost favor throughout the 80s and 90s across the board in the field of economics to what you term market fundamentalism. And, you know, you do a stellar critique of market fundamentalism in the book. But what was, I mean, how did market fundamentalism contribute to the crisis of 2007 to 2009?
Well, it contributed in several ways. The first was led to the view that there was no need for regulation, that after all, markets would take care of themselves, markets were efficient. Any intervention in the market, therefore, had to be counterproductive. The best thing to do is leave it to the market. And that led to the stripping away of regulations, repeal of Glass-Steagall. It meant that you did not impose regulations, even as the need for it became evident. We bailed out long-term capital management in 1998. A single hedge fund almost brought down the whole global financial markets. And at the time, a lot of people said it was evident that we needed to regulate derivatives, these very explosive products. And yet people like Greenspan and Rubin argued, no, that would be interfering with the wonders of the market. So that's one way that it contributed. Secondly, it meant that people who were appointed as regulators were people who didn't believe in regulation. And so no wonder that when you had people who didn't believe in regulation as the regulator, we didn't get very effective regulation. And thirdly, these people were also responsible for the conduct of monetary policy. So when a bubble started growing in the housing market, they denied it. In fact, it became part of the orthodoxy that bubbles couldn't exist. After all, if a bubble existed, it would be evidence that the market was not efficient, and the religion said markets had to be efficient. So they came up with all kinds of arguments like bubbles, even if a bubble existed, you can't tell, we don't have the instruments, better to deflate the bubble, better to clean up the mess than to try to interfere with the wonders of the market. Now, I don't think anybody believes that today. The cost of cleaning up after the breaking of this bubble is literally in the trillions of dollars. And, of course, you can never be sure that there's a bubble until after it breaks, but it was increasingly clear that there was a bubble. After all, housing prices were soaring through the roof, while most Americans' incomes, adjusted for inflation, was actually going down. Now, how could they afford this increasing spending more and more money on housing? And all that it would take would be an increase in the interest rates from the abnormal level of around 1% to more normal levels, and the whole house of cards would come crashing down, and that's precisely what happened.
One of the themes in the book that you talk about, one of the centers of the crisis, is the bubble, especially around first with mortgage, but really the broad financial bubble that led to the bailouts of the major banks and allowing one or two to collapse. And, you know, I think this is confusing to a lot of Americans because it's, you know, what role does finance play? Why did this become such an enormous problem after really seemingly having successful banking system, you know, for a generation or two prior to this? You know, can you just clarify why finance grew to the extent it did and why that was a problem for the economy?
Well, first, you should remember that we've actually had problems with financial systems over and over again. We've had lots of bubbles and lots of financial crises historically. There's only been a period of about three decades and after the Great Depression that we did not have financial crises as a recurrent phenomena. And the reason was that after the Great Depression, we asked what had caused the Great Depression, and it was one of the factors contributing to it was inadequate financial regulation. We passed good for regulations. They worked. But then the free market ideology that we were talking about before led to stripping away the regulations and not adopting new regulation under Reagan and bipartisan, both parties, after that. The financial markets have actually a very simple task. What they're supposed to do is allocate capital, and they're supposed to manage risk. And the notion is that if they do those tasks well, the economy is more productive, and that helps the economy grow, and they get a part of their contribution to making the economy more efficient. But unfortunately, financial markets often don't do that. They get subjected to irrational enthusiasms, irrational exuberance. They also, though, have distorted incentive structures, and those got worse than they'd ever been. Their innovation was directed at how could they make money in the short run, even if it imposed cost on the rest of society in the long run. And that's exactly what happened. Their short-sighted, excessive risk-taking generated for the bankers enormous amounts of money, helped lead to the bubble. And even after the bubble broke, they walked off with hundreds of millions of dollars, whereas the taxpayers had to pick up the tab, and the cost imposed on the rest of the economy and workers, on homeowners, have been enormous.
And in fact, Professor Stiglitz, in your book, I think that the way you describe the process and assemble the data and the cost that people are paying, and frankly, the corruption of the entire process, is really outrageous. There's really no other word, I think, in the English language to accurately capture the process you're describing. And as I read your book, it struck me that, and I want to talk about both the Bush and Obama administration's responses to the crisis and policies in a second, but before we get to it, I must say it struck me that the degree of sort of our political system being dominated by financial interests, to be blunt, just came through. It just seemed I'm not a cynic by nature, but it was quite stunning the degree to which the financial interests got their way.
That's right. Not a surprise, given the magnitude of the financial contributions, campaign contributions, given that they have five lobbyists for every congressperson. But a third factor contributing to it is the revolving door that we repeatedly draw upon those from finance to run that part of the government, to run the Treasury, and then too often they leave to go back to Wall Street. What's so interesting about this is that the financial sector talks about the importance of incentives and that incentives help motivate people. And almost every economist agrees that incentives matter. But if you believe that, then you have to understand that the system of revolving doors creates a real problem of incentives, of a conflict of interest, and raising questions whether these individuals are serving the national interest or their own interest. And, of course, in any particular case, you want to believe that these are honest people serving the national interest. But when you have a system like that, it certainly raises questions and should make you feel uneasy, which is why we've tried to curtail it but clearly haven't done a good enough job.
Well, you talk in the book about the Obama administration and it's the team that they assembled or that Obama assembled personally to be as sort of quarterbacks of dealing with the economic crisis, who still remain in power. What is your assessment of Obama's team and their policies 1 year out?
Well, there was one other factor I should have mentioned
okay.
in my previous remark, which is it's not just incentives, it's mindsets. And when you think about things in a particular way for a very long time, it's very hard to change. So one of the problems of many of the people on the team is that they were among those who believed in this deregulation movement.
Mm-hmm.
They thought of stripping away the regulations and not doing anything about derivatives and passing legislation saying that the regulators could not do anything about derivatives. They thought of that as part of their contribution to the economy.
Mm-hmm.
It always worries one if they thought of that as one of their major contributions. Are they going to be able to quickly shift gears and say, now our task is to undo everything that they had spent previous years doing and start putting in place the right regulation? That contributes to the problems in several ways. One of them is that if you've helped create the problems, you're going to try to underestimate the magnitude of the problems. And the result of that is that when Obama became the president, he had a stimulus package, and he did something about the mortgages, but both of those were too little. We needed at least a $1 trillion, $1.2 trillion stimulus package. We got only $800 billion. And in fact, he was given a choice between $800 and $600 billion, and he pushed for the larger amount, but what was needed was far more than that. Secondly, the mortgages, you know, were at the, almost you might say, the root of the problem. I mentioned in the book, I referred to the what was going on was like a mass blood transfusion to a patient suffering from internal hemorrhaging, but not doing anything about it. It was a kind of trickle-down economics, throw enough money at the banks, and maybe some of it will go down to ordinary homeowners. Well, again, as I say, it was good that he did something, but the fact of the matter is that the hemorrhage, the foreclosures are continuing at pace. We expect more foreclosures in 2010 than in 2009 or 2008. So that's all of these are results of underestimating the magnitude of the problem. And totally understandable if you have been very linked to some of the policies that have led to the problem.
And here
the other side is the failure yet to do anything about restoring adequate regulation.
Yes, and that's one of the themes of the book. I mean, despite everything that happened, the recognition of the crisis, we still have a largely the same regulatory system that got us into the mess in the first place going strong.
That's right. And you might say at least we now know what we should change. But we've been very slow to doing anything about it. And some of the proposals that were put forward early on clearly didn't make sense, and you could understand them, again, coming from a mindset of those who had been involved in the creation of the problem. So, for instance, at the center of the failures was the Fed, not so much in the context of monetary policy, but in its role as a regulator. It didn't even use all the powers that it had, and it should have recognized that there was a bubble in the formation, and if it didn't think it had enough powers, gone to Congress to ask for it. But it was part of this ideology that bubbles don't exist, so obviously it didn't want to do anything about it. Well, what was the response? There a proposal coming out of the House of Representatives and from the administration was to keep the Fed as the regulator, even after the Fed challenged the right of the American citizens to know what they were doing. Bloomberg sued them to try to find out where was the money going. And they said, no, we're not subjected to Freedom of Information Act like other bodies of government. We don't have to tell you what we're doing. And then the courts agreed with Bloomberg. And then instead of turning over the information as requested, they said, we're going to appeal and we're going to fight this. And yet this part of the government that doesn't seem to believe in the kind of accountability is what the administration and the House of Representatives wanted to give more power to. To me, it was a little bit a surprise, you might put it. But the other things that we need to do is some of them finally the administration is beginning to do something about. Too big to fail banks, problems of excessive leverage, problems of conflicts of interest, proprietary trading inside the commercial banks. But there are other things that we clearly need to do, something about the derivatives, the credit default swaps. We need to do something about the incentives. As I mentioned before, the banks have incentives, the bankers have incentives for short-sighted behavior and excessive risk-taking. They did what their incentives led them to, and we obviously have to do something about that.
Our guest, Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, author of the new book, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy, just published by Norton. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. We pre-recorded this program, so please don't try to call in today. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy the program as much as possible. One of the things you write in the book, Professor Stiglitz, is the likelihood, I think I've got that term right, that we may well be entering a Japanese-style malaise for the coming years, maybe decade. And I think that I understood what you're referring to, but I suspect a lot of our listeners don't quite know what you mean. Could you talk about, what that term is when you say Japanese-style malaise and what that future looks like for Americans?
Well, Japan had a remarkably fast growth in the period after World War II and winding up to be the second largest economy in the world. But in 1989, as a result of liberalization, deregulation, remarkably similar to America's experience, that they had a bubble. And then the bubble broke, and their economy entered into a new phase of what can only be described as stagnation. They've remained in that for close to two decades. There would be a little period where they grow a little, and then they a little bit of close to zero, a little bit negative growth, but there have been close to zero growth for almost two decades. Now, America is not likely to be quite that slow growth, but there's a big difference. In Japan, the labor force has been stagnant. In America, our labor force grows almost 1% a year. The import of that is that our style of stagnation may have a little bit more growth than Japan's, but the standards of living won't be going up because our population, of course, is growing in the way that Japan's is not. If we GDP doesn't grow, per capita income will be going down. So we need to grow more. If we are going to, in some sense, have the same standard of living. But things are worse than that because what most Americans care about are jobs. And the Japanese economy managed throughout this period of stagnation to have much lower unemployment rates than the American economy. American economy now, official unemployment rate is just short of 10%, but more than one out of six Americans who would like a full-time job can't get one. And if you look at particular demographic groups like Afro-American, Afro-American youth, those numbers are much, much higher, almost mind-boggling. And that's especially when you talk about youth unemployment, you're creating problems for the future, not only economic problems but social problems. So to me, the prospects are of it is very important for us to get a robust recovery so we can create jobs for the new entrants in the labor force. And to be quite frank, prospects of doing that are very bleak. Even optimistic scenarios coming out of the CBO and other official sources say that it'll be the middle of the decade before unemployment returns back to normal. And I think we should realize that that is an optimistic scenario and assumes that policy actually, the right policies are put in place.
Well, that's a sobering assessment, Professor Stiglitz. Before I want to go into that in a second, but I don't know if you remember The Onion, the humor magazine, had a headline in 2008 at the time of the crash and said, Americans anxiously wait for new bubble so the economy will grow again. And, it was actually one of those insightful headlines because when you were talking about Japan being in stagnation for two decades, if we hadn't had our bubbles for the last two decades, be they tech or real estate or financial bubbles, would we have had a stagnating economy? Were those bubbles necessary to keep us out of Japan?
That's a very good question, and I think you're emphasizing something that's very important, that the bubbles have played a very big role in the success of the U.S. economy, or the supposed success. But there's a big difference between the bubble of this decade, the real estate bubble, and the bubble of the previous decade, because the tech bubble left in its aftermath a legacy. We had innovations that we would not otherwise have had. We had companies that were founded that have continued to be big successes. The real estate bubble is leaving nothing in its wake except devastated lives, devastated communities, devastated families. Families with owing more money with owing more money on their house than the value of their house, negative equity as we call it, and their dreams of a future life have been destroyed. So, what really worries me is that unlike some of the previous bubbles, getting out of the mess that this bubble created will not be easy.
You know, in the book, you talk occasionally about Scandinavia, specifically Sweden, usually, as demonstrating ways that governments can, very productively and constructively participate in the economy to improve the quality of lives of the people in the country. And I'm wondering how much is the Keynesian position, your economic position, similar to the sort of basic social democratic position of Northern Europe? Is that more or less the position you're advocating the United States adopt?
Yes. There are somewhat different issues. The Keynesian, Keynes was really focusing mostly on what we call the macroeconomics. How does government intervene to help economies maintain full employment, jobs for everybody who wants one? Mm-hmm. And a society that doesn't do that is obviously something's wrong. And you might say this is a basic expectation of government in a modern era. And so the social democratic movement in Europe, Northern Europe, has taken that on as a first responsibility, and we did, actually, in the Full Employment Act of 1946. Unfortunately, we haven't always lived up to that, nor have they in Europe. The second thing, though, is, you might say, the role of government more broadly. When I say more broadly, I mean at least in two or three respects. First of all, government is part of innovation, and it is part of American tradition. The first telegraph line was funded by the U.S. government. The burst of productivity in agriculture that makes such a big difference in the 19th century was funded by the U.S. government. And the Internet was funded. The biotech was funded by the U.S. government. So a lot of the things that have really transformed our lives have been the result of basic research or, in some cases, even applied research that are part of government. And the Northern European governments have recognized this. But they've also recognized something that we, too, in America have recognized, but we've continued to debate about, that there's an important role for government in, you might call it, social protection and social services. Most Americans are really glad that we didn't privatize Social Security, as President Bush wanted back in 2005. People may not remember, but he was pushing for that. And had we followed his advice, the devastation to our retirees as a result of the collapse of the stock market would have been enormous. We would have really soup kitchens in the United States if he had been successful in pushing for the privatization of Social Security. So we should be thankful that we did not do that. But in Sweden, they've also realized that sometimes people need help, for instance, to facilitate women entering the labor market, managing the difficulties of babies, you know, when they have a child, and making sure that the labor market can help a woman balance the demands of the family and the demands of the workplace. And so they've entered to help out. And they've done it very deliberately, saying, look, if we're going to grow, we have to use all of our talent, and that includes women. And the market doesn't seem to help enough for women to have any to enter to be as productive as they could, and so the government's helped them along. Now, not every society may come to the same conclusion, but at least they opened up that debate, and I think it's an interesting discussion.
I think one of the things that grows out of the Swedish experiment that you talk about in the book, not in that context, but you talk about for America and what we should be concerned with here, is the whole issue of inequality and economic inequality as being something that's very bad for a functioning economy, not something that's, you know, unlike some economists who argue that it spurs poor people to work harder. Your position struck me as being far more of the camp that this is something that really drags an economy down. Could you explain your thinking on that issue?
Yeah, and actually I try to relate it to the current crisis. One of the things that Keynes emphasized, pointed out, was that lower income people spend more of their money than of their income than upper income individuals. Obvious, you know, if your income is so low that you can just barely get by, you spend every dollar that you get, and upper income individuals don't. So that as we've gotten more and more inequality, in effect, you can think of that as redistributing money from people who would spend it to those who don't. Now, in the United States, those are not only those at the bottom, but even those in the middle and above the middle have been doing very badly. Most Americans may not realize that, even though GDP has been growing year after year until the recession. Most Americans were doing poor year after year, so that by 2008, real income adjusted for inflation was in the middle, was 4% below what it was in 2000. So people in the middle, let alone those at the bottom, were doing worse and worse. What we, in effect, told these people is, don't let that bother you. Just keep consuming as if your income was going up. You know, live the American dream, which is money, your income is going up year after year, even though reality was telling you otherwise. And, of course, the way you did that was very simple, debt, borrow. But people could do that because they believed that their homes were getting worth more and more. And that was the bubble. So the bubble enabled people to live beyond their means. Well, now we've been brought back to reality. House prices have fallen on average 30%, in some parts of the country 50%. And more middle-class Americans are waking up to the fact that they were living in a dream. And that is what's contributing to a weak economy. They know they cannot spend in the way that they did. And while it's good that they get brought back to reality, if they're not spending, the economy is weak. The economy is weak. Unemployment is high. That increases anxiety. It's a downward vicious circle. What has happened, of course, is that the government has tried to step in. But that brings us to one of the big political issues today. Some people want to forget about Keynesian economics and go back to the Herbert Hoover days and cut back government expenditures. And if we do, then the likelihood is we'll enter back into recession, or at least into very low growth.
And might make the Japan malaise look like a golden age.
That's right. And in fact, one of the things that we learned from the Japanese experience is that they, about 8 years into their malaise, into their slow growth, they felt, oh, we're finally over these problems. Our national debt is high, and they raised taxes. And, of course, right after that, their economy sunk into a recession again. the fear is that we will follow that same kind of course.
Our guest today, Joseph Stiglitz, author of Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy, just out by Norton. Joseph Stiglitz, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics and professor at Columbia, former chief economist at the World Bank. It's an honor to have him as our guest. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters, again, a pre-recorded program. Don't try to call in. Let us do the talking. Professor Stiglitz, if you could, were put on the hot seat and you got a phone call from the President of the United States and asked you for your top three things you would recommend he consider doing to put the economy on better footing going forward into this decade, are there a few things that you have on the tip of your tongue you'd like to mention to him?
Sure. The first is we need a second round of stimulus focused more on jobs, better designed, but when they passed the first round of stimulus, the Obama team underestimated, as I mentioned before, the severity of the economic downturn. And they thought we were going to have 10% unemployment, and their package would bring it down to 8%. But instead, we would have probably had 12%. The package, the stimulus, brought it down to 10%. Well, when you see that the problem is worse, you need to increase the dosage of the medicine, and we need a jobs-focused second round of stimulus. The president realizes that we need something, do something about jobs, but what seems to be wending its way through Congress is too small. Secondly, we still have not done anything adequate for the mortgage market. One quarter of Americans owe more on their mortgages than the value of their mortgage. 2.5 to 3.5 million foreclosures expected this year. We've done nothing about these homes, the mortgages that are underwater, and we need to restructure them. We need a homeowner's Chapter 11, a way of restructuring rapidly. We've recognized the principle that businesses that need a fresh start should get one. It's important for saving their jobs. Well, I think it's important to save American families, keep them in their homes. Doesn't do anybody any good to throw them out of their homes. And so we need to do something about it. I give some very specific proposals, but there are others that we ought to be considering. And thirdly, bank regulation. The banks are not lending. They're making profits to a large extent through speculation, causing actually bubbles in countries around the world. But meanwhile, not leading to growth back here in the United States. And no wonder their incentives are not directed at doing what they should be doing. So we really need to have a new regulatory regime to prevent a recurrence, but not just to prevent a recurrence of the kind of crisis that we had, but to direct their attention to doing what financial sectors, the banks, are supposed to be doing. So there's a long list that I give in the book of what needs to be done. It's actually pretty simple, and we understand most of the ingredients: incentives, transparency, excessive risk-taking. But unfortunately, so far, the banks have been winning, and very little has been done.
Do you think that there would also need maybe bold new gestures just for creating employment beyond sort of stopping the bleeding now? Or do you think, more or less, if we do what you say, that the system will then sort of fall into shape and will be a high-growth economy again?
Oh, no, I think we need to do a lot more. I mean, we have problems, long-run problems, before the crisis. Those problems haven't gone away. The problems have festered, and unfortunately, the way we handled the crisis, including the poorly designed bank bailout, has left us more in debt and with less resources to handle these long-run problems. But one of the long-run problems, for instance, was could we compete in manufacturing? And we've lost a lot of our manufacturing base. Some people will say, well, that's the problem of being a rich country. But that's not true. Germany is a major exporter, including major exporter of high-tech manufactured goods. But they have an educational system that and a support of technology that helps them be competitive. So we, you know, we complain about unfair exchange rates. The real problem is that we haven't been investing in education and technology and infrastructure, other investments to make ourselves competitive.
You know, along those lines, you talk in the book about the American higher educational systems, particularly our research universities, as being a real engine for growth and innovation and one of the great strong points of the U.S. political economy. Yet it seems right now, and of course I'm speaking from self-interest here at the University of Illinois, but right now, our public universities in particular, research universities and also colleges, four-year colleges, are under, you know, probably the most severe strain they've ever been under in their history.
That's right. And one of my criticisms of the Obama stimulus is it didn't have the kind of vision of where we needed, where we ought to be going. You know, it should have said what we want to do is to help our economy become more competitive in the future. Well, that means recognize that there's the crisis, the recession, is really affecting some of our more competitive some of our areas like education very critically. And it's not just the public, it's the private, because they've lost, the private endowed universities have lost a very large fraction of their endowments. So it's across the board we are suffering. And it doesn't make any sense. We could have used some more of that stimulus money to help the universities, which would at the same time create jobs now and improve our productivity going forward.
Professor Stiglitz, having spoken with lots of people about our economy and callers in the program and friends and acquaintances, I know that the question many of them would have for me in this situation, so I'm going to ask you, is if the Obama administration so far really hasn't really seized the bull by the proverbial horns and, as you point out, in many respects has really continued the same general set of policies as was the Bush administration, sometimes the same people, are there political forces in Washington that are advocating the sort of reforms you're talking about who are in play, or are those forces just completely on the sidelines or non-existent? I mean, is there any hope to get the sort of policy reforms you're talking about considered and passed?
Yeah, there is some hope. There are a number of NGOs and other a number of groups working very hard, for instance, for reform of our financial system to make it focus on what it should be doing. The question is, the balance of money is clearly on the side of the financial sector. They can spend far more money than those who are trying to get reform. On the other hand, the good news is the votes are more on the side of the of those who want financial reform, because I think Americans realize that something is very wrong with the way our financial system works. Emblematic of that was the fact that when we were pouring money into the banks, allegedly to help them be able to lend more money to the rest of Americans, they were pouring money out in dividends and bonuses, and that nothing was a clear articulation of the fact that their perspectives, their objectives, their concerns were markedly different from the rest of America.
Professor Joseph Stiglitz, we've only got a few minutes left. I've got a lot of questions I'd love to ask, but I think I'll go to the one that I want to make sure you address, because I don't know the answer at all to this one, and I'm eager to hear your answer. The United States has been the dominant power in the global economy for a very long time, at least 60 or 70 years, if not longer. And it seems clear, at least it seems that a lot of people think it's clear, that the U.S. role is of one of decline relative to the rest of the dominant powers of the world. And China is coming out and eventually will assume that mantle at some point in this century. should we be concerned as Americans about this? I mean, are we going to be losing some great things by no longer being top dog, whether it's our currency is the top currency, or is this something we should, you know, just deal with? And should we be concerned about the ascension of another country to top dog status like China?
We should be concerned a little bit, but on the economic side, those concerns really reflect a misunderstanding of economics as if it were a zero sum. Their gain is our expense. That's not true. From an economic point of view, we can both benefit if they grow faster. We've benefited enormously by their growth in the form of cheaper goods, and if it hadn't been for the enormous increases of productivity, we would have faced inflation in the 90s, and we would have faced a lower standard of living today. So we both have something to gain if we manage our economic policy correctly, which means we have to do investing just like they are doing investing. We have to do investing in technology, education, infrastructure, and a whole wide range of other areas. Politically, things are a little bit more complicated. We live in a global world, in a world of globalization, where what one country does affect others. We are competing for some natural resources, and we are competing for influence. And what is clear is that our ability to dictate our perspectives, our views on the rest of the world, is no longer going to be what it was. But those days, there was a short period between the fall of the Berlin Wall and I say September 15th, the fall of Lehman Brothers, when we were hegemonic. Those days are over, and we are going to have to live in a world with a much more multipolar world.
Last question, Professor Stiglitz. The research shows that much of the news coverage of the business community, the financial sector, housing market, before the crash was deeply flawed and left Americans really unprepared for what happened thanks to the business news media and political news media. For my listeners out there who want to follow economics, can you recommend some news media or websites they might go to where they might stay on top of these issues and not be getting fed housing industry propaganda or banking industry propaganda?
Yeah, no, I can't really answer that because there is no single source. There are lots of different sources. The thing that I just encourage people to do is to read with skepticism and read widely.
Well, Professor Joseph Stiglitz, I'm going to thank you for taking time out of your very valuable schedule to join us here at Media Matters. It's been an honor having you as our guest.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure. And I want to thank Mike Pritchard for producing today's show. My name is Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. We'll be back 167 hours from right now. Have a good week, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
A mostly sunny day is in our forecast for today. It'll be breezy, high near 74. And then tonight, thunderstorms are expected to accompany a cold front that'll move through the region. probably after midnight, there's a slight chance that some may reach severe levels because of hail and strong winds. The overnight low, 57. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, high near 77. This is Illinois Public Media, WYLL, AM 580 and FM 90.9, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.